Honorable members, welcome. We apologize for the delay because our colleagues didn't keep time, and that affected us. I will ask the representative of NICO to come to the front. That's Mrs. Veneva Agayachi. She is accompanied by a colleague who will be arriving soon. Oh, okay. What is her name? Oh, okay. Let me just say from the outset that I took time to look at submissions. I was actually disappointed by my own fellow lawyers because they deal with technicalities and forget that law applies to human beings, especially women and children. And when I looked at the submissions of the Women's Legal Center and NICO, I really thought that this meeting was about NICO and the Women's Center, because they put the human face to what we are here. And the other things you can see, it's really power struggles as to whom will work go if this interpretation of this formulation is accepted. So I hope that as members of parliament, we are not going to be technical. We are also going to look at how does what we are doing improve the lives of people. And welcome. And I think it's good that you are here.
Chairperson, before you go on, if I may address you. Yeah, Chair, whilst you are quite correct in saying that we must always remind ourselves of this portfolio committee that we're dealing with the lives of human beings. The safety net for human beings is also for us as a committee to technically deal with the legislation in front of us. So if we fall into the trap of not sending to Parliament for approval good legislation, technically and otherwise, then also the human beings we serve will suffer. So my plea is just that we should not overemphasize the human element of society. We are a portfolio committee of justice. And by definition, we work with legislation, which by definition is technical of nature. We should be very wary of overemphasizing other matters but the law in this committee. Thank you.
I can agree with you more. We have to show that the law is technically correct, but if the content is wrong, then we are going nowhere. So that's why we deal with the formal aspects of the law and the substantive aspects of the law. So I know that we are used to the formal aspects. So I was just reminding us that the substantive aspect is actually very important. Because even under the tree, where you don't write anything, there's justice. Because people look at the substance. But thank you for that contribution. We have restored the balance and we will observe that balance. Proceed.
Good morning. I thank the chairperson and the committee for hearing us this morning. I think we appreciate both the comments about the substantive content of the law as well as the need for good legislation. So I don't think we're disputing that. Our particular presentation is talking about creating a legal aid system in South Africa for children and youth. Now, I know we're very much aware that we do have the Child Justice Act and its regulations and the Children's Act, but what NICO is finding, we're finding gaps There's a lot in terms of the procedural aspect of the law, but like the chairperson mentioned, we are dealing with cases where children seem to be falling through the gaps, and that's why we think our presentation is important. We are not the technical law writer, and we hope that you can interpret what we are telling you into actual legislation. So we're not going to focus on the clause-by-clause aspect of the bill. You do have our submission in front of you, but I do apologize. We also prepared a PowerPoint, and I wish to circulate it to you after that's possible, because we just added a few additional stuff. So basically how Nicola has interpreted the provision of legal aid is much more comprehensive than the current bill provides for. We see that the bill speaks mainly to the establishment of Legal Aid South Africa and its speech about its independence and its governance and a lot of procedural issues, but does little to talk about the comprehensive provision of effective legal aid in South Africa. And we know that obviously to allow for the comprehensive provision, it may either mean amendments to the current legislation or it may mean including drafting of regulations about the issues that we're going to be talking about. When we talk about comprehensive legal aid provision, we are talking about legal aid that includes legal advice, assistance and representation, education, mechanisms for restorative justice, and alternative dispute resolution. Further, we are talking about legal aid not dependent on lawyers or legal people, but includes other service providers at a community level, working in NGOs, offering similar legal support to people that are coming through our system. And it does include traditional and alternative mechanisms for assistance. Our submission will focus largely on what does it mean to provide legal aid when we talk about the poor and the vulnerable, and women and children as one of those vulnerable. We'd like to unpack what does it mean when we talk about the access of legal aid for children, looking specifically at child and adolescent development and behaviors, and how does this affect criminal capacity, offending behavior, sentencing options, and participation in the legal process. Now, the implications are, what does this then also mean for the training of legal representatives? Now, we know that the Legal Practice Bill covers a lot around regulation of continued professional development of attorneys, but it doesn't provide any regulations, and I know in that bill it talks about providing regulations. They can do regulations, and we want to propose regulations related to children. I mean, what do you train legal representatives on when it comes to children? And that's what we're finding is the difficulty. Irina will explain to you. Irina Smith, sorry, she's going to present me. She's a clinical social worker at our organization, and she has a specialization in children. She deals a lot with criminal capacity assessment. And so she'll be able to explain to you what some of the examples of the cases we're dealing with and what we mean when we say the law is not adequately covering the needs of these children. Our concern is the negative impact of the present punitive system of justice. And I know I say this, the whole aim of the Child Justice Act was to create a separate system of justice for children, but it's not happening adequately. So we're not in through our eyes. And we really believe that its training has a large part to play with regard to that as well as looking at how we can develop further regulation. And so we would like to call for additional provisions for children and access to legal representation in the legislation, because there's no way that the legal aid bill even mentions poor and vulnerable or children. And in specific regulations, although in the legal practice bill about training, but I think we need to look at the content of that training and some competencies and all of that. And I think we're not without legal frameworks to guide us in this, because there's international instruments, international and regional instruments that guide us in looking at legal aid for the vulnerable, including children. The Lilongwe Declaration of Accessing Legal Aid in the Criminal Justice System in Africa 2004 says, it characterizes the provision and access of legal aid as a human right, particularly in the criminal law context, and calls on governments to adopt measures and allocate sufficient funding to ensure an effective and transparent method of delivering legal aid to the poor and vulnerable, especially women and children, and in so doing, empower them. We do need a legal aid, which is a system of distinction. I think we need to work towards creating a legal aid system on par with those that do have legal representation, making a law of tall order. But we are not supposing that a legal aid system uses necessarily inexperienced attorneys, but it can work towards really providing the best legal aid we can to the poor and vulnerable. And we know we've got challenges currently with that. I know there's lots of efforts on legal aid, South Africa's part, and there have been great strides in improvement, but there's still gaps. And I just want to share with you some anecdotal accounts of what we hear from clients, just to show you what the current present system of legal aid, where the gaps are. And some of these were provided by clients and professionals. I only saw a legal aid attorney once, and then I saw him in court. I do not know what is happening in terms of my case. My attorney did not appear in court today, and my case was remanded. The judge said it was because my attorney was not in court. And professionals, attorneys or legal aid attorneys, do not always understand the processes when it comes to child justice and children's health issues. They do not ask the right questions when it comes to children. It is often very difficult to access legal aid attorney or attorneys about a child who has just been arrested. Legal aid attorneys do their minimum and don't put the case at its merits. We don't see a human rights activism kind of role. Legal aid attorneys at times push the children out to plead guilty and they don't know all the options and focus on legalities and the charge and look to find the easiest way out. I just wanted to provide that to kind of give you the essence of what we're talking about. And besides, I mean, we understand the issues of the poor administration of justice. We know the administration of justice is a challenge right now. We have huge crime rates, and it's quite difficult to kind of get all of that, but we know that the justice system is trying to look at case flow and all of that. But what we find in the legal aid system is sometimes there's an inexperience of attorneys. There's delays in justice, and we know that justice delayed is justice denied. Access to information, inadequate preparation at times, lack of capacity to deal with the needs of the poor and the vulnerable, and not protecting the right of fair trial. Cases go on, and there's multiple postponements. And we don't find a caliber of legal aid attorney that could look at why cases are senselessly postponed, for instance. We find attorneys not familiar with diversion, non-custodial, or alternative sentencing, and diversion, and the differences between the two. We don't find that legal aid attorneys do enough to advocate for alternatives, and we have talked about the issue of representation. But I think to get to the heart of the point, and this is what I'm going to bring in my colleague now, what is the, if we look at the legal aid system currently, we need to ask the question, what is the status then of providing representation to children? Are we treating children differently from adults? Do we have an adequate understanding of what that difference is? Do we have adequate resources for the services that those children need for effective rehabilitation and reintegration into society? For example, is there affordable and available therapeutic services for children? And we find no, there isn't. Legal, social, and cultural norms, as well as practical constraints, may complicate issues of justice for children and things that we need to look at. Every day we find children come into criminal justice system and decisions are made that affect the rest of their lives. What rights do these children have when they come into conflict with the law? Are they automatically entitled to legal representation and broader legal representation? If so, how best might these services be made available and actually reach children in crisis? And how can legal aid be made child-friendly? In Canada and South Africa, every day many children suffer violations of their rights. They may be detained with adult prisoners, are exposed to torture, physical and emotional abuse. Even the current state of child and youth care centers are also of concern, with similar abuses reported, and can believe there's no independent oversight over the facilities of child and youth care centers. In South Africa, we once again need to have a robust discussion on how best to provide children with meaningful, effective, affordable, and age-appropriate legal assistance. I'm not going to go into all instruments. I think they're in your document. As I said, there's international instruments that talk to children and the poor vulnerable. Specifically, they talk about ongoing training that needs to be provided to, and I think that's the basis of our presentation as well. The UN Convention, for example, let me just mention it, on the rights of the child talks about, it refers to a child representative and states that any system of justice assistance should take a child's evolving capacity into account and other issues pertinent to the needs of the child, which has implications for training of legal representatives. The UN Standard Minimum Rules, the Administration of Juvenile Justice, talk about in-service training, refresher courses, other modes of instruction utilized to establish and maintain the nation's professional competence of all personnel dealing with juvenile cases. And then the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child 207 talks about legal aid can also be provided by social workers, paralegals, and others, but caution that anyone who provides legal aid to a child must have sufficient knowledge and understanding of the various legal aspects of the process of juvenile justice and must be trained to work with children in conflict with the law. and the Council of Europe Guidelines on Child Chain Justice. It talks about lawyers representing children should be trained in knowledgeable on children's rights and related issues, receive ongoing and in-depth training, and be capable of communicating with children and young people at the level of their understanding. Now I'm going to call my colleague, and she's going to talk to UNICEF and the UNODC's definition quickly. I was just going to just give you a definition, and then Ms. Smith is going to just talk us through it. UNICEF and the UNODC provided a definition in their recent report on child-friendly legal aid in Africa. And they talked about the provision of legal assistance to children in criminal, civil, and administrative proceedings that is accessible, age-appropriate, multidisciplinary, effective, and is responsive to the range of legal and social needs faced by children and youth. Child-friendly legal aid is delivered by lawyers and non-lawyers who are trained in children's law and on child and adolescent development, and are able to communicate effectively with children and their caretakers. And so as I call on Ms. Smith through your chair, she's going to explain a bit more about what understanding child and adolescent development is and why is it fundamental that legal representatives understand children's behaviors and how to fix legal proceedings.
Thank you very much. We'll take the whole thing, but you have expertly summarized everything. Thank you very much. Ms. Smith?
Technology is not one of my best my strengths. Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you very much again for the committee allowing me as well to bring in with regards to the NICO expertise and the work that we do with children, specifically in conflict with the law. I think the important part of what I'm presenting is about why do we need to look at legislation specifically in relation to children. As Marcus mentioned earlier, there is, you know, the Child Justice Act and the whole setup of a separate system with regards to children and dealing with children, but we still find that children are not necessarily treated as children within the criminal justice system. We also recognize with regards to that the whole focus on the process and the procedures and then often the leaving behind of the child in the whole process and in the procedures. So for us, what is quite important here is truly for legal aid representatives, for people that have to go and represent these children in the courts, to really understand what is the real difference between an adult and a child. It's not merely an issue of age, it is an issue of development, and particularly with regards to development of the brain and what children can and cannot really comprehend and think about. I think one of the things that we find a lot of the time as well is that, you know, we talk to children as if they are adults, and we expect that they need to understand what is really happening to them. So when we look at MRI research, for example, we can see that inside the developing brain there is actually a maturational process going on, and that the brains of children and adolescents and adults is significantly different from each other. So even adolescents do not have the capacity that we think they should have, because we expect that they should be now almost an adult and they should think in the way that we think. So evolution from childhood to adulthood is marked by significant physical, cognitive, and emotional developmental changes. And these changes have a significant impact in terms of how children present themselves, in terms of how children can understand what is happening to them, and then obviously has an implication in terms of how children can engage and the support that children need when they are in the criminal justice system and they need to be represented. So the biological basis for us in terms of the difference between adults and children is very important when we work with children and when we represent children. So two findings in particular is quite relevant in understanding the children's behavior and their ability to participate in legal proceedings, as well as understanding the offending behavior. And this is the whole thing of the gray matter, the frontal lobes, which is our seat, or what we love to tell the children, which is the brex of your behavior, your judgment area, not being fully developed up to probably up to the age of about 26, they found that even young adults up to the age of 26 has developmental issues still with frontal lobes and not being fully mature. So that is the last part, because the brain develops from the back to front, and that is the last part of the brain to mature and to be able to function the way that we would want it to function. That is why we also find, when we look at young adults, why we can see a lot of young people in their 20s getting into really silly situations sometimes, and we wonder, why haven't they thought about this? Why haven't they thought about the consequences? Because the brain, in certain cases, cannot necessarily always apply those breaks and make those judgments in the situations that we want them to make it. And obviously that is amplified if the person is under a lot of emotional or psychological stress related to other things as well. So children rely then heavily on those parts of the brain that is more fully developed, which is more the emotional and the instinct aspects of their behavior. So as a result, children and adolescents, obviously, their levels of risk-taking, impulsivity, long-range planning and decision-making is very much different from that of an adult. And this is then relevant in the ability to make decisions, including legal decisions, and communicating with legal practitioners. And just for example, if we think about it, also other factors that come into play, social factors. If we think about children that we've worked with, for example, we very often don't know whether a child are represented or not represented. Where we see children coming in with huge problems, a child that literally, I can give a letter to you that if we do not address an issue at this point in time in this child's life, this child will, at the time when he's 16, 17 or 18 years, be in court again for probably a more serious crime, for probably more things that have happened. And yet, at that point in time when the child is in the court, for example, if he's 14 or 13 years old, we do not know whether there are any legal representatives actually there. If the child is represented, if the child is not represented, we undertake criminal capacity assessments, which has a huge impact on the case in the court and what will happen to this child. And yet we do not have any contact with any legal representatives. We do not know if that person is there. Yeah. So I think for us what is very important with regards to this is that children needs to, legal representation for children is basically something that is not negotiable, because it can turn out quite bad for certain children. And that is why the legal representation, or the people that provide the legal representation, need to understand this and need to understand what is happening with children. And if we just look at other issues as well that goes together with that, the civil issues that emerge from a lot of these cases, where children are involved in criminal cases, and we just start doing background checks and we start doing those investigations to provide reports to court, what do we see? Children that have gone through tremendous divorces, children that have been used in divorce cases where mother and father is playing them up against one another, children who have got a lot of trauma at the end of the day. And we ask ourselves, where was the legal representation in these cases when divorces was happening, when children don't have places to live, and now it's a criminal matter? So these are just some of the examples that we're talking about. I mean, I'm thinking of a 16-year-old with brain damage after two road traffic accidents. There was a number of cases where this child has been involved. There's been some civil issues where this family has been involved in, and yet when we go back into history, what do we find? You know, this child could have been assisted so much earlier in the process if there was a representation and a person that could tell us with regards to the law, where could we go and look for assistance, and where could we go with regards to these things. So the question that I just want to ask is then, when does the legal representation by an attorney begin for children, and how do they interact with other professionals working with the child? Where does it begin and where does it end? Is it only when a child goes to trial? Does it happen when the child is arrested? The preliminary inquiry, when you talk about the Child Justice Act, all of those, well, we're just trying to figure out where in this whole picture of children having a lot of issues showing, ending up in the criminal justice system, where does it begin to get those legal representatives in for them? And yes, I think that is where myself, in terms of just working with children and finding what I see with them on a day-to-day basis, where I'm then concluding my part of it. Thank you very much.
Ms.
take my seat back, sorry.
I And thank you very much for your input. I think it's quite clear that we have a difficulty with having a definition of what is legal. I hope members will address that question when we come to it. And also, the question of law is not operating in the vacuum. Law is operating within society. And society is not just about technical rules. There are other sectors in society which can and should contribute to what we understand by law and how we apply the law. There's also law and culture, law and religion, law and human development. And when we make laws, we need to turn a blind eye to all those things. So I hope that the discussion will also not regard those aspects as irrelevant. We now turn to see Mental Health Center or the Commission for Gender. Now we can refuse us.
Sorry, we have to leave. So, is there any questions that we could ask the committee? You're going to only take questions later. We have to be somewhere up, unfortunately.
You know, when we invite you, we invite you on the basis that you are available the whole day.
We've got another presentation. Sorry, we did explain this to
Parliament.
No, it's another place that you have to present. Yeah.
Just double checking. You know, the issues that you have raised, unless you don't take them seriously, are very important issues, which require intervention.
Okay, so I'll negotiate that Mrs. Smith will go. I will stay. She can. But I will stay and help.
No, you are both going to stay. I also want you to hear the other input. Members will have questions, and if you are not there to answer those questions, because you just not have been presented. CGE, what is it? There's men represent women. So the patriarchy is taken right to the
Checking correct the perception?
Yes.
CG is about gender. It's not about women only. And this is why you see a man sit there to come and talk about the commission on gender equality.
Thank you for free education. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Member Majakis. And good morning, everybody. Also, Chair, thank you for this opportunity to present to this Honourable Committee as well. Chair, before I begin, on this issue in Dalton, I had a tragedy during the course of last week, and I'm aware I lost my brother. So the submission was done by a colleague of mine, the one that you have on record. For you, I want to withdraw that submission. And the presentation that I'm making now will constitute a fair reflection of the submission that's going to be submitted later in the day to you. I trust that this will be accessible to you today. And to my esteemed colleague, Mr. Bassett.
I'm sorry, I'm a bit confused about what's withdrawn and what's not withdrawn. Are we saying that this document is withdrawn?
say to you that this is correct, Honorable Member. This is a document that I want to bring on record, and it will be the one that I want, or I would like to be accepted as a submission. And the proper format will be submitted later in the day. And the submission that's held on record, as the members pointed out in the back, that I would like to withdraw. No. This is the official one. And the one on... Yeah, the other one is unofficial one. It doesn't bear my signature.
I think the other one will regard as coming from the whistleblower. And we have read... we can't ignore what we found in it. So I think continue. That may be a very bad reflection on ourselves, that you come from the same office, you can produce two radically different documents, and the other one is official, the other one is not. Now, anyway, proceed, we make our own judgment.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Quite a note, I was going to call you my worship. The approach we're taking is that we just want to look at the substantive aspects of this bill, and as the Chair pointed out earlier, we want to give it the face of gender. So that's our primary focus in this submission. If you refer to page 2 of my presentation, there I point out to the constitutional and the legal mandate of the Commission for Gender Equality. I mean, our mandate is to promote, protect, and develop respect for gender equality in South Africa. So I won't go through all that in detail. Our mandate is also on page 3, expanded in terms of PEPUDA, the promotion of equality and prevention of unfair discrimination act. And to a large extent, I mean, the power that's bestowed upon the CGE is to undertake investigation in the quality courts. And that's the primary or almost the most important powers ascribed to the CGE in terms of PEPUDA. In terms of international obligations, I just want to point out to what CEDAW states in terms of Article 15, which relates to access to justice in relation to women and gender. The same points of Article 15 is that state parties shall accord to women in civil matters the same opportunities to that of men. It simply means, I mean, when interpreted and applied, it means that women should have the same opportunities to defend themselves in matters such as divorce actions and unfair maintenance orders. Now, we know for a fact that generally men are the breadwinners and they have better financial resources. But when it comes to divorce matters, which has a lot of implications in terms of patrimonial consequences, where you look at the dissolution of the estate, maintenance orders, the upkeep of children and so on, which flow out of divorce actions, men are able to defend themselves better primarily because of their financial resources. They are breadwinners and women come off second best. And also in our cost monitoring initiatives, we find that a lot of women struggle to get maintenance orders that are equitable and that are fair. That's just one aspect. And the other aspect is that because men are in a better position, they tend to evade their obligations in respect of maintenance. And women really have a tough time. And it's good to see that this is being addressed in terms of the National Credit Amendment Act, which blacklists deposits and maintenance. So we thank this committee for also looking at that. Then when we go to page 5, in terms of our regional responsibilities in terms of access to justice, and the SADC Protocol on Gender and Development, Article 6 speaks to this, and I want to read it out. Firstly, it states that state parties shall review, amend, and repeal all laws that discriminate on the ground of sex or gender by 2015. Secondly, Article 6 also speaks to other important aspects. And more especially states that state parties shall enact and enforce legislation to firstly ensure equal access and protection to justice. Secondly, state parties must take action to abolish the minority status of women that's contained in legislation by 2015. Thirdly, state parties must also take action to eliminate practices which are detrimental to the achievement of the rights of women. And this relates to aspects such as Bukatwala, which is still practiced. And also, state parties should take steps to eliminate gender-based violence in respect of legislative measures as well. Then on page 7, they are referred to Section 9 of the Constitution, which refers to the Equality Clause. And I think this committee is well versed as to what the nature of the Equality Clause is. In page 8, the FCG is concerned about the gender mainstreaming of the Legal Aid Bill. Firstly, we place on record that we welcome this bill and we support its intentions. We think it's quite well drafted and it has good intentions and we support it therefore. A very small concern that we have with clause 4, paragraph F, it is supported. But what we find is that when it's pitched against the obligations outlined herein, it will be referred to the international obligations and the provisions in other pieces of legislation, especially the CEDA. We find that the expectations in 4F is not fully realized in this piece of legislation because emphasis is placed mostly on criminal cases. And we found that in the last financial year, Legal Aid South Africa dealt with 438,844 new criminal matters, as opposed to 55,277 new civil matters. And these civil matters include maintenance matters and divorces. Now, when you analyze that, before I even look at that analysis, we find in the 2012-2013 financial year of the Legal Aid South Africa, that 55,277 new civil matters represented a 75% increase in the load of civil matters. In other words, what this simply means is that in the 2011-2012 financial year, the most probably was about 12,500 new civil matters. So to us now, what we're looking at now, when you pitch the approach of the Legal Aid South Africa to the allocation of its resources in terms of the Equality Clause and our international obligations, women are definitely being shortchanged. Now why are we saying this? We're saying this purely because if you look at who commits most of the crimes in South Africa, if you break it in terms of gender, you find it's mostly men. Even if you look at our prison population, it's almost 90% men and under 10% women. So the resources, the 1.277 billion rands that was allocated to Legal Aid South Africa, the bulk of it went to addressing the needs of men as opposed to women. So you can see the uneven balances. That's how we look at it. It is an unfair split of the financial resources of Legal Aid South Africa. And that needs to be addressed. And it's not being addressed in this bill. And our recommendation is that, firstly, an express undertaking to divorces, domestic violence, and related matters should be targeted in this piece of legislation. Secondly, Legal Aid South Africa should, in terms of clause 4, paragraph F, also expressly provide for legal representation in equality courts to support this initiative, because we find that the equality courts are struggling purely because they are not given prominence and there's no resources being channeled into that area. And it's not that the Department of Justice is not doing its work, but not interested in uplifting or giving prominence to these courts. It's just that the other agencies are not supporting it. Even legal practitioners themselves are not seeking remedies in the equality courts. Finally, in an attempt to realize the intention of Clause 4F, the Bill should explicitly provide for legal representation in the Protecting Women Against Gender-Based Violence in matters such as State v. Jazila, which is in the Cape High Court. And that matter relates to Okutwala. And in terms of our international obligations and even the equality clause, it states that we must protect women. I mean, I don't understand why Legal Aid South Africa hasn't offered assistance to the persons concerned there. So this is a kind of uneven allocation of resources we're talking about. And also last, in 2012, there was a case of, I apologize. It's Mojaji versus Mayelani. Thank you very much for that. In the Constitutional Court, the issue related to where the spouse entered into a customary marriage, a subsequent customary marriage, without registering or without getting the permission of his first spouse. In other words, there was a husband and a wife in a customary marriage. Then the husband entered into a second customary marriage without getting the permission of his first wife. And then the second wife, they took the matter to the, his first wife took the matter to the High Court. And the High Court held that the second marriage was invalid because the husband did not get permission from the first spouse to enter the second marriage. And that had to go to the Constitutional Court to be clarified, or for the matter to be given clarity. Now, issues such as this, it costs a lot of money, and we find that even if one or two cases of this nature is actually dealt with by the legal aid agency, it would help. And this addresses the needs of women substantially. In respect of Clause 6, firstly, the CD recommends that this clause be revised to ensure that the birth addict is representative in terms of gender. That this escaped the process, I think. And in terms of Clause 7, the CG is encouraged by the current form of Clause 7, Paragraph C, which seeks to promote diversity. Well done to you. In respect, there's a page where I haven't numbered. It's actually just before page 13. My apologies for that. Where we refer to duty care. The CG believes that when duty care matters are being allocated, it should be done in a manner where the historically disadvantaged and women legal practitioners are able to benefit from such initiatives. Finally, the CG is pleased to observe that Legal Aid South Africa has 50.6% employees who are women. And that's quite good. And finally, we'd like to thank this committee for the opportunity to present before this committee. We thank this committee for considering our submissions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appears again that the needs of the most vulnerable are actually not taken into account, and that we are not actually distinguishing between legal representation and legal assistance. And the fact that criminals, although it's a constitutional imperative, criminals get more catered for than the victims. You know, in the interpretation of the law, we say lawmakers don't intend absurd consequences. But I think that honorable members must consider whether it is not absurd to say give more protection to the aggressors than to the victims. So we want to thank you for raising these issues sharply. But also the fact that marrying another wife without the consent of another one should go to the Constitutional Court, and the state must pay for those kinds of things. Why can't the others sit around the table and really deal with some of this matter? Because even if you win the case in the highest court, the consequence may be that this man is going to divorce that wife who is giving him problems. Now we have social problems, and the law will have disappeared by that time. But these are matters that maybe must be discussed further, not in this course, but elsewhere. Can we now move on to the men's legal center? One man, one woman.
Thank you, Chief. I'm Miss. Please don't marry me.
Oh, Miss.
Miss Bornham, yes. Thank you. Thanks very much to the honourable members and honourable chair for giving us this opportunity to make some brief oral submissions around this particular bill. I'm not going to take up too much time of the committee. Our written submissions are quite brief, and I intend for my oral submission to follow suit. The Women's Legal Centre is a non-government organisation, for those of you unfamiliar with the centre, whose core objective is to advance and protect the human rights of women in South Africa. The WLC was founded in 1999, and this year we celebrate our 15th year of existence, and our core mandate is to conduct constitutional and impact litigation on behalf of women in order to promote and protect women's human rights and to advance gender equality in South Africa. In many respects, my colleague from the CGE has already done my job for me this morning, so thanks for that. But I will expand on some of the points we make in our written submissions. Some examples of the cases that we've been involved in of late are, in fact, the Jazili and Ngonyama matters that my colleague at the CGE spoke of, and so that gives you an idea of the kinds of cases that we deal with at the center. In addition to doing constitutional and impact litigation on behalf of women and in the public interest, we also promote access to justice for women and girls by providing free legal advice to women on a daily basis. And this is through making available the services of our attorneys and paralegals to attend to women who visit our offices, physically walk through our doors, who call our offices on phone or who send us emails with legal queries. And we also provide legal support to a range of organizations that seek to protect women's rights. Now, these submissions of ours are mainly based on this practical experience that we have of what the needs of women are and what our clients report to us about their experiences in both moving through the criminal justice system as well as some of our civil legal systems. So we begin by looking at the notion of substantive equality. And we all know that equality forms a central pillar of the new South African legal order and that it is a foundational value of the Constitution, and that Section 9 guarantees equality before the law and equal protection as well as benefits of the law. The Constitutional Court has interpreted Section 9 to be a provision that speaks of and protects substantive equality as opposed to formal equality. In other words, when we speak of equality in South Africa, it must be equality in outcomes. As my colleague again has already mentioned, women continue to be the poorest demographic of South African society and least likely to be employed, least likely to be educated or to own property, and most likely to be the victims of gender-based violence. It is widely recognized that access to justice for everyone in South Africa remains a big challenge. However, due to this unfair, indirect discrimination we often see being perpetrated against women in terms of structural inequalities in our society, the constitutional rights of women to access to justice and access to courts are often disproportionately eroded in comparison to those of men. So when we look at the national crime statistics, for example, it doesn't really disclose much information about the perpetrators of crime in South Africa, and one is not exactly able to ascertain from those national crime statistics what proportion of perpetrators are female and what proportion are male. But what the national crime statistics do tell us is that women are most often the victims of sexual offences. And research also indicates that women suffer the brunt of domestic violence, the statistics for which are not collected separately, but we know that those incidences of domestic violence is subsumed into the statistic around things like assault, criminuria, and other sexual offences within the stats. So it's a hidden problem in many ways, but we know from research that it's a very big problem. And through our legal advice program, the Women's Legal Centre has also identified other trends in terms of where women are most needing assistance in terms of interacting with the legal systems, both criminal and civil. And we believe that these trends indicate an important aspect to consider in putting in place legal aid legislation that does not inadvertently and indirectly discriminate against women. So looking firstly, I think, at domestic violence. The Domestic Violence Act, as well as the New Protection from Harassment Act, provide for a civil law, not a criminal law, but civil law mechanism that aims to provide protection for victims of domestic violence and harassment in the form of a protection order. These protection orders are issued by a civil magistrate court upon application by a victim. The victim's perpetrator subsequently have to appear in court on a specified day in order to put their respective case before the court. And this process is designed to be easy to use and accessible to members of the public, the majority of which will be women, which is what the statistics are telling us. However, the experiences of our clients at the centre who seek legal advice and assistance from us have shown that the process is not, in fact, as accessible as it is intended to be. A client's day in court still takes the form of a mini-trial with legal rules applicable to examination, cross-examination, evidence and procedure, and clients find the process very intimidating and, for the most part, quite shrouded in mystery. And although clerks, court clerks and magistrates play a leading role in this process and can guide and provide advice to clients, the client's inability to navigate and understand the subtleties of the legal process and applicable rules remain a significant barrier to having successful outcomes in places like domestic violence courts. So we specifically identified through our clients the following challenges that women are facing in terms of trying to obtain protection orders in terms of the Domestic Violence Act as well as the Protection from Harassment Act. Firstly, women are not sufficiently assisted to complete the application forms that launch the process, which result in unsuccessful applications for protection orders or a protection order that does not in fact take into account the lived realities of that particular woman's life. Then, when it comes to the actual day in court, women must often face perpetrators that are legally represented, most of them being men, when they themselves cannot be legally represented by a private practitioner due to a lack of financial means to obtain that kind of legal assistance during their day in court. The result is that women with strong cases are sometimes unsuccessful in court and unsuccessful in obtaining a final protection order due to also the onerous technical nature of the process, which I've spoken about already. Then looking a bit further at some of the statistics, and I would like to refer you to page 7 of the Women's Legal Centre submission. We've given you a short table indicating the number of legal queries that we deal with on an annual basis. Now, the footprint and the reach of our legal assistance is nothing compared to that of legal aid, but we believe that these trends that we see in our own officers duplicate themselves on the national level and in the legal aid statistics coming out every year. So if you look at the total number of queries per year from 2007 until last year, we can see that there are significant amounts of civil matters, including things like divorce, maintenance, and other family law type matters, especially relating to relationship rights, that consistently make up over half of what women come to us for when they need assistance. So it gives an indication of the amount of clients that we see and what proportion of those clients ask us for help with criminal matters and what proportion of those clients ask us for help with civil matters. And it is clear that civil matters consistently make up over half of what women are needing assistance with. And most often, the reason why women seek out the Women's Legal Center services is not only to obtain legal advice. Most of the time, women also want legal representation, and that is why they come to us. Now, the problem with legal representation is because the mandate of the center is to do constitutional and impact litigation, it's not always possible to take every matter that comes through the door. So we refer clients to places like Legal Aid and the pro bono programs that happen through law societies. But by and large, in order to access the kind of legal aid, a client must pass a means test. In other words, clients who earn a certain amount of money do not qualify for free legal assistance, and this is a process and a system that we're all familiar with. But even the lived reality of many women in South Africa and the structural inequalities that I've spoken about briefly, it's not surprising to us that while many of our clients fail the means test, they are still not in a position to retain private legal services. So in effect, they're not poor enough to qualify for legal aid, but not rich enough to be able to pay for the services of a private lawyer. And often, in the process of conducting that means test, the very assets that are included in calculation and cause that particular client to fail the means test is, in fact, the assets that are the subject of the legal disputes with which a client needs assistance. For example, a divorce where the client may be married in community of property, they jointly own a home, that asset is taken into account in the application of the means test, but it is the ownership of that very home that is the contentious issue in the divorce proceedings and in respect to which the client needs assistance. So law societies also generally make provision for pro bono services, but the same means test that we just referred to is applied in the context of legal aid, also applies to pro bono referrals. And these pro bono referrals, there are also restrictions on the types of matters that may be referred for pro bono assistance. So this often discourages attorneys from taking on complicated matters, which in turn restrict access to justice through legal representation in that avenue. So I think this emphasizes the important role that legal aid can potentially play here in extending access to legal representation to women in our society who really and truly need it. So really, in terms of our recommendations, the main critique that we have of the existing bill is that the regulatory emphasis of this particular bill that stands at the moment seems to fall mainly on legal aid for defendants in criminal law matters. And it's set out quite extensively in Section 22 of the bill. And this is happening perhaps at the expense of civil matters, which can be and can have consequences just as weighty as a bad outcome in a criminal case. So, and we see this every day through our clients. And we see how people lose houses, lose access or in custody of their children, and these events are no more dramatic or significant in a person's life than having been found guilty of theft or whatever case may be. So the fact that the bill does not therefore explicitly provide for and regulate legal aid representation in certain types of civil matters as well does to some extent give rise to indirect discrimination against women, and in the sense that it results in more men than women benefiting from legal representation in court, precisely because men tend to be perpetrators of crimes where the majority of legal representation is being provided. So our recommendations for this bill are quite general, quite broad, and in the light of our submissions, we really only have two core general recommendations. The one is it relates to the re-evaluation of the means test, and we feel that perhaps the bill should provide expressly for the periodic review of the means test to accommodate inflation and really the lived reality of South Africans, and especially women, who are far more likely to be unable to afford private legal representation as opposed to men. This kind of express inclusion of a mechanism for reviewing and keeping up to date the means test will close that gap between the people who currently are able to afford or who qualify for legal aid and those who are currently not qualifying for legal aid but still are unable, genuinely unable, to obtain private legal representation or assistance. The second recommendation is about the review of the types of matters for which legal aid representation is currently provided. And again, we believe that it would be a considerable step forward for legal aid in South Africa if the types of matters for which legal aid representation is currently provided could be expressly extended in this piece of legislation, and a provision could make for legal aid representation even in matters that are not necessarily opposed, that are or will run in civil courts, and that specifically also relates to domestic violence or harassment, to ensure improved and more equitable legal outcomes for everyone, but especially for women. Thank you.
Thank you very much. a very good presentation. Well, no, again, it's quite clear that the system is weighted in favor of criminals. And that raises also the question whether our legal education is really adequate. Because if you know how to formulate the rules, apply the rules, but you don't understand society, you can't deliver justice. So it appears that we don't understand the society to which these rules apply. And it comes out quite clearly here that legal advice, legal assistance, is very important, but the focus is on legal representation. And if you have a women's center responsible for legal advice and it doesn't qualify for legal aid, it means they are carrying a burden which does not belong to them. And if they also have to refer this matter elsewhere, doesn't that mean that there's a need for legal advice centers to do the work that they are doing, which actually should not belong to them? And that means that the whole question of public interest law practice is left behind. And legal practitioners are business people. So we are catering for business people, not for the big people. I think we need to address this thing. Otherwise, we must just say we are not concerned with justice, but business. So if we are all concerned with business, then we must say so. With your permission, I would like to ask Legal Aid South Africa to speak, and then we break for tea, and then we come back for discussion. I'm not a prosecutor, so I'm sure.
Thank you, Chief. Just from Legal Aid South Africa perspective, thank you. I don't intend to respond to, and I don't think this is the forum which to respond to, the issues that have been presented today. That will obviously follow as part of the process. But I think what I can generally say, that a lot of the issues that were raised are currently dealt with in the Legal Aid Guide and will form part of the regulations as well as the manual in terms of procedures or the handbook within the current proposed legislation. But also one of the issues that we've got to remember, that a lot of the things that are proposed to come into the legislation, whether by the regulations or the Act itself carries financial implications. And that those have to be fully understood in relation to the overall budget. So from a Legal Aid South Africa, we say thank you, and we take seriously the inputs that are received, and they will be considered. We have just really four main issues in terms of the bill from an input, and more on a technical front, Chair, which really deals firstly with the issues in relation to the composition and the appointment of the board. The first one being in regard to the manner of appointment of the chairperson, where the current draft bill requires the Chief Justice to make the nomination. But we've proposed that this be done in consultation or after consultation with the board. This will then obviously promote and assist us in terms of, from a board perspective, with sufficient planning so that you can see, ensure a smooth transition between the incumbent chair of a board and the new chair of the board coming in, so that you can see the smooth transition, which leads to a sustainable and a well-led board. If you're not able to plan those kinds of successions, it becomes difficult to have a well-led board that is sustainable. And I think we've seen that in the past, and the history has now reflected how that ongoing and sustainable leadership of a board is critical. In regard to the membership and qualification for membership of the board, we've specifically proposed that it be amended so that it refers to Section 69 of the Companies Act. We don't feel it's necessary to go and rewrite it all into the Legal Aid Bill, that you can refer to the Companies Act, and the criteria that are applicable there should be the similar criteria that are applicable for members of the board to be able to qualify for the board. In regard to the third aspect that we're concerned about for the board is then the term of appointment for members of the board. The current bill says that they should be appointed for 3 years and not more than 5 years, which may only be renewed on one additional term. Now, the concern from our perspective is that to maintain a sustainable board, you do need a mix of experience and institutional knowledge in your board members, as well as bringing in and bringing through new board members and to gain the necessary experience. And so therefore, in terms of the specifically the retention and maintenance of scarce skills on a board and the institutional and expertise and institutional memory, it becomes critical that the board be able to balance that. And if you by legislation restrict that ability to balance, it could impact and compromise the overall experience or expertise or independence of the board if the board were not able to have a look and consider their composition specifically on those grounds. And then lastly, on the fourth aspect, the termination of membership of the board, there's a specific issue in terms of whether the term comes to an end automatically or not, and I think we feel the clause should make it clear that the term will expire automatically after the period that is mentioned in the appointment, unless that term is renewed before the expiration of that period, and that should be clarified within the bill. Then more not on a technical issue, but in terms of flow, we feel that the current clause 23 should become clause 24, and current clause 24 should become clause 23. The basis of that submission is that the current clause 24 deals with the regulations. The regulations contain the substance in terms of policy, in terms of the types of matters which legal aid will be available, in terms of the means test, and deals with the substantive policy issues from a legal aid perspective. Whereas the legal aid manual, which is currently then placed first, only really deals with procedure as to how someone would access, what's the process to apply for legal aid, and how the system is administered. So we feel that those are more process issues and should come after the policy section. And that's just really the proposal made in regard to the Health Safe for that. We then fully support the board chair. Thank you. Thank you.
You know, honorable members, I think there's one issue that we will have to address. Namely, that the law that we seek to replace was made at a time when we had a minority government which had made education compulsory for the minority. And the result was the issues raised here were all irrelevant because we were dealing with a different kind of state. And that's why, for instance, in your presentation, you are actually dealing with the transformation of the structure or restructuring. But the structure that we are restructuring is supposed to deliver justice and therefore to make a law that only reorganizes the structure without looking at the social reality becomes a problem. I think that we have to take this opportunity to really bring about radical transformation of the provision of legal aid in the country. And therefore, we confine ourselves, in my view, to just that. I'm just sharing. The most important people are sitting there, so they will have their time to address this issue. But I think that restructuring on transformation must be formal and substantive. At the moment, we're dealing with the formalities and not the substance of issues. Thank you very much. Can we now break for tea or coffee and then come back for the discussion? You know, I pity you, and I would want to release one of you, but in future, please, when you come to Parliament, you come to Parliament. And I actually wanted to hear Mrs. Smith responding to questions.
Sir, can't you just ask them the questions before they leave? I think they open for questions just for them in 22
minutes. Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, well, I hope members will support us so that I think they made a very important discussion. For the question, please.
Well, for me to the comment to thank Nico for the submission. The submission that was just much more based on your worry about provisions that are supposed to be used in relation to disasters. I would actually say that the comment has been noted. And just to say that it was quite fascinating to see the line of discussion that it took, also taking into consideration some of the challenges, serious challenges that we've got currently in South Africa related to NICO. But just to say, thank you very much for the input.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to raise the question regarding on page 5 of the remarks made by NICO. Where it deals with the Committee on the Rights of the Child, and it talks about legal aid being provided by even social workers, paralegals, or others who must have sufficient knowledge and understanding of the various legal aspects of the process of juvenile justice. And maybe I just want to engage the representatives of NICO on this, because on the one hand we sit with a situation where already we say that quite possibly the quality of legal aid provided by those employed by Legal Aid South Africa at this stage in terms of their representation is not always up to scratch. So I want to engage them on whether they think it would be possible for people, let's leave aside paralegals for a moment, social workers or other, to have a sufficient understanding firstly of the process, and whether as an understanding of the process alone is sufficient to provide legal aid, or whether they propose that this is sort of like working in a tag team with a lawyer. And then secondly, whether they feel that this issue could also be addressed if, for example, in every office of Legal Aid South Africa, a process is driven to also capacitate people in the employment of Legal Aid South Africa in additional further training to work as specialists in terms of providing legal services to children. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. First, I would like to thank Nico for the presentation. I should say this, that they are playing quite a very important role in terms of ensuring that the juveniles get proper treatment in courts. But I just want to know from them, I think I want to take the line of the Honorable next to me. I hear all the lamentations that are in the document in terms of all other things that are funding and so on. So don't they think that they should be strengthening legal aid in a sense that legal aid is able to get the people who are trained fairer than those that are in the system, who get better training to ensure that they just attend to that aspect of the children, but not necessarily to get a lot of input on this specific legislation, because I have a feeling that there must be we must empower the Child Justice Act to take its proper effect than to want to smuggle issues that we're supposed to raise in that other act to this one specifically. So I think we're out of line for this particular act. So that is why I wanted them to be here to just clarify us, who don't they think that we need to concentrate on the Child Justice Act? It's a point of departure. Then we look at how legal aid can be strengthened them in terms of giving this important service that they are giving. Even if it means some funding, because I always see them on TV requesting donations. Somebody will say on TV, we want donation, Nico is doing this and this and this, Child Justice. So don't you think a role that we can play in terms of maybe we are giving them something so that they are able to attend to that specific aspect and to smuggle issues that are of a particular angle into this specific matter? Thank you.
Yeah, I'm not sure if this is only for members, or can I raise comments? Okay, I'm from Legal Aid South Africa, so I feel that it's a good opportunity to also respond to some of the issues raised about this. I think that there are always different versions of what is happening, so I think it's important in terms of what the honourable member just previously said, that we should look at the issue of the Child Justice Act and the implementation of that, which I agree with. And I think in the past, the committee devoted many sessions specifically to that, and I think that is an important area. And that the issues that are required for that, and the issue, for example, of representation, at the hearings, as an example, was debated a lot in the committees, and I think that it was covered in particular ways, and that it was clearly that it would regulate, would only provide that when the presiding officer required, because of funding constraints, which the committee and the department actually promoted, and that's the way in which it works. I think there are many issues raised about the issues of quality, which in terms of training, and I think that this may not be the forum to clarify all of that, because we do have a different version of what from what Nico is putting, obviously, as Legal Aid South Africa and as the people who are providing the service, in terms of the effort we make. And I think at the last meeting when we were here, we also explained to the committee how we track children, and every child is tracked individually, etc. So if you have time, we can go into that and respond to it, but I just wanted to remind the committee that there's also other ways of looking at it, and that We welcome all the suggestions, and we would always welcome how we could improve our own services. But we should be mindful of the quantum, not money terms, but of the need and the way in which we divide our resources. The second issue is the issue of the way in which we deal with issues in the bill and in regulations. I think the issues of who and what representation we provide will be debated by this committee again in regulations. It's not something that we can legislate because it becomes very onerous in terms of putting energy. And the way in which we divide resources, for example, also links to that and the issue of historically what the Constitution required us, what courts have ordered us to do. And I think a key thing that the committee should apply its mind at some point is if we want to shift the civil aspect to greater numbers than we have done, we are going to have to look at the Constitution again, because the constitutional imperative is primarily on certain things. And so that's another aspect that must be looked at in terms of the issue. So I think that in relation to looking at the issues that are being raised, we need to be mindful of that, and that when we have an opportunity to look at the regulations, we can say this, we can look at how much money we have, and then decide how we want to divide it. So if we want to divide it differently, for example, between criminal and civil, that's definitely an opportunity where the ministry and the department, especially the minister from the department, had it all. And luckily, we do advisement as such, and we have paralegal at every of our offices, and we work very closely with the advice officers across the country also, where we provide support to them, and we also link to them, where they, in terms of advice they provide, and if they need to go beyond that legal representation, then we send our legal practitioners to also provide that. So I just thought that I can add those messages so that it adds to the whole information before you.
As you see, the issues that they raises a question whether lawyers are sufficiently trained to deal with issues. Our lawyers are made to understand technicalities and so on, and they apply the law. But there is a social aspect. Are these lawyers qualified? Maybe we should, it's not the right forum here, but we maybe also have to address the training of lawyers. Lawyers who know nothing about sociology, criminology, social work, and they've got to go and address the issues. It may be that we're dealing with the inadequacy of legal training. But also, you see, when you deal with you say you support paralegals advice centers, some of the issues that you address can be better dealt with in a community setting. So you need a community-based justice system, and that would offload some of these things from technically trained people. I don't know, and you know, maybe I'm biased towards Nicro and the women, but what I like about what they say, they give us empirical evidence of the problems on the ground. They are not just interpreting the rules. We'll break for tea, but I think we need sufficient time to deal with this issue. I still have the impression that we are more concerned with legalities than substantive justice. Thank you very much. Enjoy that scene. You want to respond? Oh, okay. Sorry, just a minute.
I won't take you from your key. Just a response, because we will take opportunity to. So I just want to thank you for all of your comments. And with due respect to Legal Aid South Africa, I think I did mention that it's not, we have had a relationship and we continue to forge a relationship with Legal Aid South Africa. And it doesn't mean that they don't have any strides. But when you look at budget allocations and the issue of providing comprehensive legal aid for South Africa, we just don't have the means right now to provide it at its best. And that's the problem. It is not always at its best. And it's not always because, legal aid South Africa is not necessarily trying to do the best they can. So just with that in mind, but we would like to work closer in saying that with legal aid South Africa. We have lots and lots and years of experience working with child development. and we would like to look at those regulations in consultation with Legal Aid South Africa and the legal profession. And I know the legal practice board does make provisions for that, because it says you can determine after consultation with relevant authors and legal practitioners in general conditions relating to the nature and extent of continuing education, and it looks at working NGOs around that. So there is provision in that piece of legislation, but we do support the need for regulations when it comes to provisions for children, so what you have said. And to answer the gentleman, yes, I do agree social workers are like me to understand the law for sure, similarly legal practitioners, they need to get an exchange of information. And I like your term, the tag team, because we do need to work as a team, and I think that's what we identified as a team. We work as social workers and we're providing input, but we don't necessarily have contact with the legal representation. And sometimes I think it would be nice as a team, because that legal aid representative provides evidence on the best interests of the child. How does that legal representative interpret, and I know the magistrate and the judge also interpret the evidence before him, but I think if we had more contact with each other, we would provide better evidence for children in the best interest. So I do think there's a gap in terms of how we work together. And show your whole issue by community justice and how we can work together on the ground to provide a better form of justice for children is important.
You see, we're sitting here, the legal practitioner, attorney, advocate, they send us paper, they're not here. And then we are here to solve the problem of how to give them more money, not to solve the problem of people. So they don't need to take that seriously. Thank you very much.